Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Practice Groups, was recorded on Thursday, July 2, 2015, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call. Today our call is with Senator Mike Lee. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of experts on today's call, and this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome a special return guest to Teleform. He is Senator Mike Lee, senator from the great state of Utah, a great Federal Society friend, and author of the book, Our Lost Constitution, The Willful Subversion of America's Founding Document. But today he's going to be speaking to us about American exceptionalism and various other topics as we head into our celebration of Independence Day. With that, Senator Lee, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Dean. It's a pleasure to be with you on this call today. I'm really happy to be here to help celebrate Liberty Month. I'll be doing so by saying a few things about American exceptionalism, including what it is, how it has manifested itself, some of the challenges it faces, and how we can meet those challenges. So let's start with what American exceptionalism is. The twin pillars of American exceptionalism, I believe, are our free enterprise system and our voluntary civil society. These two pillars, in turn, are composed of certain key elements. Now, our free enterprise system in America depends on equal opportunity, the core idea of which is that success can be earned by anyone, and it has to be. If you work hard and play by the rules, you can get ahead. Our voluntary civic life, I think, depends on what I consider to be the fundamental foundational unit of society, which is the family, and the array of heroic and empowering communities that free individuals form. This is what free individuals do when they're allowed to be free. You look to any church, any charity, little league, neighborhood, or business, and you'll see a key component of American exceptionalism. American exceptionalism also depends on service. That is a willingness to advance in life by helping your neighbors to do the same. And ultimately, American exceptionalism does not depend on bankers in boardrooms, politicians at the podium, or even on the great iconic leaders of our past. Instead, at its core is the attitude of ordinary citizens, stubbornly committed to defending their God-given right to self-government. Now, these hallmarks of American civilization that make us exceptional among nations have been the driving force behind some of the most seismic events in human history and some of the greatest advances of mankind. It was indeed American exceptionalism that defeated fascism and imperialism on the battlefields of the Second World War and helped rebuild Western Europe and the Pacific in the aftermath. It was American exceptionalism that freed Eastern Europe from the scourge of communism. And it's American exceptionalism that has led the world for over a century in economic development, medical and scientific advances, and technological innovation. It is American exceptionalism that has, since our founding, offered countless generations of citizens, pilgrims, settlers, and immigrants the chance for a better life of upward mobility, so long as they're willing to work hard and play by the rules. And at the start of Liberty Month, it's worth reminding ourselves that 239 years ago, this Saturday, it was American exceptionalism that caused the delegates of the Second Continental Congress to declare America a free and independent nation. Despite all of this, however, we can't take these basic precepts for granted. Cronyism, for example, is a uniquely malignant threat to American exceptionalism. It corrupts our economy and our government by forcing Americans who do themselves work hard and play by the rules to prop up, bail out, and subsidize elite special interests that don't. It endangers growth and innovation by burying new ideas and competitors under a morass of red tape in order to protect the beneficiaries of the status quo. It undermines equal opportunity by redistributing opportunity from the poor and middle class to government itself, and also to its clients and its cronies, those who are given the levers of government and power. Here's another example. President Obama has attempted to offer a path to citizenship, entitlement benefits, and work permits to millions of immigrants who have broken the law. This breaks the basic bargain that if people want to come here and be part of the American dream, they need to follow the rules in order to get into our society, in order to become citizens, and in order to have the chance to succeed that so many other people outside the country are patiently awaiting. These are both challenges that violate the golden rule of American exceptionalism. That is, if you work hard and play by the rules, you can get ahead. So what can we do about this? Well, addressing the challenges and ensuring the vitality of Americans exceptional character are tasks of ineffable importance because, as Thomas Paine wrote in 1776, the cause of America is in a great measure the cause of all mankind. And so it is worth considering what steps we should take to meet these challenges and to ensure that the next generation will know from its own experience rather than from memories and historical evidence why ours is an exceptional nation. To address the regulatory burdens on business, Congress should pass the RAINS Act, which would require congressional approval for any regulation with an economic impact over $100 million. To put an end to cronyism, Congress should target for termination programs that represent favors and handouts to special interests like the Export-Import Bank. Congress should pass the National Right to Work Act so that Americans are free to choose whether or not to join or contribute to a union. Congress should pass the Energy Freedom and Economic Prosperity Act, phasing out all technology-specific subsidies to energy producers so that producers compete for consumer dollars rather than Washington favors. I believe, as do so many other Americans, that the founding of America was something that was brought about with a degree of divine intervention and certainly inspiration, that Americans are a unique people with a unique mission, and that this is a great country to live in. It's a great country to be a citizen of. So thank you for having me today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Well, thank you very much, Senator. Let's do get right to our audience, see what's on their minds. In a moment, we'll hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that, if you have a question for the Senator, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for Senator Lee, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And as is our custom, if you'll bear with us, let me make a quick commercial announcement about our upcoming Teleforum conference calls. We are dark tomorrow, but next week we'll have a wrap-up of the criminal cases from this term of the Supreme Court on Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time. On Tuesday, we'll be talking with Charles Murray and about his new book. That's Tuesday at 1. Wednesday at noon, we'll be hosting journalist Judith Miller, who'll be discussing her new book, which touches on overcriminalization and due process. And then on Thursday, we'll have our monthly CFPB update. And if you think the court has had a busy month, be sure to dial into that account of the latest events at the CFPB. Today, of course, we're talking to Senator Mike Lee. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button. And while we're waiting to see who might ring in here, we've got some shy guests today, Senator. Let me ask you just generally, is it your impression that American exceptionalism, as you've described it, is on the wane, or is it robust? Or you've mentioned some concerns. You've mentioned some possible remedies. What's your overall sense of the direction of the country vis-a-vis American exceptionalism?
Okay, good question. First of all, I wouldn't say that it's on the wane because I think it's still very strong. But I think that American exceptionalism, like freedom, in much the same way that Ronald Reagan described freedom, we can say that American exceptionalism isn't passed from one generation to the next through the bloodstream. It has to be continuously reinvigorated and fought for and defended. So I wouldn't say it's on the wane. I would say, however, that it isn't something that we can count on as a sort of self-perpetuating force. And for that reason, it would do us all well to recognize what the potential threats to it are. And that's why I outlined some of these things like cronyism that can undermine it. Because the more we can do to protect it, the more we can do to make sure that it'll be there tomorrow and the next day, that it'll be there for our children and our grandchildren. But if we don't, then we are at risk of becoming like most of the other nations of the world, most of the other nations that have ever existed in the history of the earth. And we don't want that to happen. We do want the American cause to be the cause of humanity. We want American exceptionalism to become the norm worldwide. In order for that to happen and for people throughout the world to enjoy the benefits that we have here, we've got to stick to what we know works well here.
Let me just interject that part of the reason we're doing this call is Liberty Month, the month of July, and the Federalist Society is, along with the Washington Times, celebrating Liberty Month as part of our July Liberty Month project. This is an education, a public education and media awareness campaign, and each weekday we'll be featuring some content in the Washington Times. You can obviously get that through home delivery, but you can also get it online. If you have a question for Senator Lee, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let's take our first call.
Senator Lee, this is David Applegate with the Chicago Lawyers Chapter. You mentioned your belief that in part American exceptionalism stems from a certain divine inspiration in this country's origins. What the progressive left seems most to bristle at, other than the notion that there is anything exceptional about America, is the notion that a higher power played any role in our country's founding or should have any role in its future. How do we who believe otherwise go about winning the hearts and minds of the secularists who seem to be winning the major battles of the day?
You know, I've thought a lot about this, and I'm not certain that there's anything that we can do to convince non-believers that they should believe. And I know that's not necessarily what you're asking, but what I think your question nonetheless gets at a similar point, at an analogous point, which is how we can convince others around us to cling to what we believe in. In other words, how to keep believers on the path of believing in American exceptionalism and in the fact that there is something special about this country and that this country and its exceptionalism have divine origins. And I think to do that, in order to protect this belief among those who share it, we've got to continue to express it. I think that most of the people, most of the time in America, are willing to acknowledge these features of who we are and how we got here. And the more those of us who feel fervently about it are willing to express it and defend it, I think the stronger it will become, notwithstanding the fact that there are and probably always will be some naysayers. It's also important to note that even among the skeptics, there are plenty of people in the United States who perhaps don't believe that there was any divine intervention in the founding of America, perhaps in part because they don't believe in the divine. They don't believe in God. There are many of those people who nonetheless believe in American exceptionalism, who don't and in fact cannot doubt and could never refute the fact that these twin pillars of American exceptionalism, our free enterprise economy and our voluntary civil society, are masterpieces that, if emulated elsewhere, would work wonders for any civilization. And so for those people, it may not matter to them whether or not they believe in divine intervention or even in the divine. As long as they believe in those things, I think they can be our allies in promoting, protecting, and defending American exceptionalism.
Thank you for that well-stated insight.
Once again, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got a few callers in the queue, so let's take another call.
Hello, Senator Lee. This is David Trine in the Cleveland chapter. So given the events that are unfolding before us in both the Supreme Court and things that the president is doing, there's a lot of dissatisfaction and angst and people being upset, people that I know and on the conservative end of things, and they're distressed that the Republicans in Congress aren't doing more to combat what they see as the damage to the Constitution, damage to the country. And so I'm just curious what the attitude is or what the feeling is among conservative Republicans such as yourself there in Washington. Are you suffering from similar angst, or are you more optimistic than those of us out here in the hinterlands of the the Midwest?
Well, it's always easier to answer that question if we're talking about a specific thing, and I know your question deals with the broader array of concerns that just relate to a certain amount of disregard for the law, disregard for the Constitution, and abuse of power within our government. I wish I had an easy answer for you. I wish I could tell you that just on the verge of stopping overreach by the executive, by the judicial branch, and by those in Congress who don't want to acknowledge the important limitations placed on our government and by each branch and each office within our government. Unfortunately, I can't tell you that. For reasons that I outlined in my book that I came out with a couple months ago that Dean mentioned earlier in this call, called Our Lost Constitution, we do have a problem in our country in that our government is populated by a whole lot of people in all three branches of government who don't necessarily view the Constitution as a document whose most important feature is to limit power. And yet that is its purpose. That's what it needs to do. I sometimes am reminded of a statement that I heard made by a prominent Utah years ago, a man named Neil Maxwell, who said that if India is the world's most religious nation and Sweden is the world's least religious nation, then America can be likened to a nation of Indians governed by Swedes. And I use that analogy here to refer not necessarily to religious belief, but to belief in limited government, constitutionally limited government. We're a nation of people who believe fervently in this thing, this concept that our founding fathers fought for and put so much time and effort into creating. I think most of the people believe in that, even though our government doesn't. Little by little, I do think we're making some progress in getting more people elected to Congress and sending the message that we want a government that is limited, and we want a government with people that's run by people who recognize important limits placed on each office within the federal government by the Constitution. We're not there yet. It's going to take a few more election cycles in order to get us closer to where we need to be. It's one of the reasons why I think the upcoming presidential election cycle is such an important one. We do have a president right now who doesn't share our view, our understanding of the Constitution. And while all three branches of government play a role in what you're describing, the executive branch certainly sets the tone for it. And it's been within the executive branch that so much of this has been dramatically accelerated. It's been the head of the executive branch who stated not too long ago that he's got a pen and a cell phone, whatever that means, suggesting that he can make his imprint on our laws with or without the assent of Congress. That has to change. And so one of the reasons why I wrote our lost constitution is to help enhance the constitutional dialogue in American politics. I think that's the only way we're going to restore it. Is we've got to talk more about it. Constitutional principles have to become part of our national political discourse. And gradually that is happening, but I think it has to accelerate rather dramatically as we enter the 2016 presidential election cycle.
Maybe we should get that put in as part of the Common Core curriculum. That would help, right?
Yes, exactly. Hey, yeah, yeah. It's got to be useful for something. Maybe you could do that.
Thank you.
All right. Let's take another call.
Senator Lee, this is Mike Doherty in Atlanta. Thanks for being on this call. It's always great to hear your comments. I get to be a little cynical with the separation of powers, and I'm being out in the world of medicine and find the vast number of people that don't really understand it anymore. And could you comment on and here's my anxiety. When I see chronic lying, just take the example of Hillary, chronic, obvious, repetitive lying, professional spin players that have no seemingly ethics or respect, I'm concerned that many in the public go numb and dumb instead of getting outraged. The assumption was that people would be outraged. But I'm concerned that when you have sophisticates like Axelrod, et cetera, pushing this stuff out early, I don't know if that's really going to work. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I tend to believe that the American people, as Winston Churchill used to say, can always be counted on to do the right thing after they've exhausted every other alternative. And I think that as we approach the choice that we'll be making in the fall of 2016 about whether to elect Hillary Clinton as president or whether alternatively to elect someone else, I want to hope and believe that we will pick someone else. And I think that's a fair assumption that the American people will reject that. Now, I worry a lot about the dynamic that you're referring to, which is that people have become numb to it. Maybe they've become accustomed to it, so accustomed perhaps that they don't see it as a big deal, that they don't see that as a deal breaker, as a reason why they should vote for someone else. But that's why those of us who feel the way we do need to talk about it and need to talk about what has been wrong with our government, some of the things that have gone wrong in the State Department under Hillary Clinton's time as Secretary of State, and why we need to talk about abuses of power during this administration. It's commonly said that a Hillary Clinton presidency would operate basically as a third term of Barack Obama, and we can't let that happen. I don't know what the outcome of that election is going to be yet, but I certainly share your concern that we shouldn't elect Barack Obama to a third term, and we shouldn't allow that to happen by electing Hillary Clinton.
They get another call.
Hi, good morning. This is Diana Pepitone from the New Jersey chapter. wanted to call in on the topic of American exceptionalism and the concern about preservation of it. And looking at it from the rising electorate, the perspective of the rising electorate, K through 12 education, what I've seen as a parent watching curriculum come home from the schools is that I see the shaping of an electorate that no longer holds or is taught the values that the current electorate may hold or the prior electorates, the values that you spoke of, you know, truth, justice, equal opportunity. These are things that we were raised on as children. We saw them in the schoolroom. We saw them in our comic book characters. We saw them throughout society, and they reinforce the ideas that I do believe undergird the idea of American exceptionalism, that there is an objective truth, that we can reach justice through our legal system, and that there is equal opportunity, but no guarantee of equal outcome. And I believe that what these children are being taught from the very earliest ages, kindergarten, say, are the ideas that truth is relative, that there is no objective truth, that there is really only seeing it from the other's perspective, that justice is really being superseded by the idea of problem solving, and again, that equal opportunity really loses out to the idea of equal outcome and how do we find equal outcomes. And so my concern is that these values being taught to the children in the K through 12 system almost require the insertion of the state in order to follow these values through, that these are not things that inspire liberty and freedom of action, but that the state necessarily inserts itself within this dynamic. And so we're raising an electorate that doesn't even operate on the paradigms that we think of and that within which our system was created. And so I'm concerned, what is there? Is there dialogue? Is this really, does this have to be a grassroots movement that makes a change here? Does it have to come through the parents, awareness on the parents' end to say, you know, we're seeing a shift, and this shift will lead, no matter all the political machinations and political efforts made through campaigning, et cetera, if your electorate has essentially shifted to a belief structure that no longer sustains American exceptionalism, have we lost the battle if we're not focusing on these younger generations?
Okay, the short answer to your question is yes. We have lost the battle if we don't focus on communicating these truths to younger generations of Americans, to today's students. And so you correctly seized on the point, which is that assuming, as it is today, fair to assume, and as one has to conclude, that the state is working against us, the only way to offset that is through grassroots activism, through parental involvement in communicating these truths, in communicating the fact that there is such thing as a correct answer. And there is also such thing as an incorrect answer. Truth can be ascertained. It's not easy to ascertain in every instance, but it does exist. It exists beyond a mere abstract effort or a mere subjective analysis. And that needs to be communicated. I also think it's important, something you said made me think about this a little bit differently, and that is that we can, in some cases, meet those who are on the side of statism on their own ground and defeat them on their own ground. Just as we believe that it is often appropriate to address certain problems on the basis of saying there is such thing as truth and we can get there. We can also meet them on their own ground by pointing out that bad things happen when you give too much power to the government. In other words, even if we don't argue it just as an absolute eternal principle, that is the case, we can point to innumerable historical examples in recent history and in ancient history in which the poor and the middle class, the common everyday people of any civilization, tend to suffer when you give too much power to the government. This is just our common experience. We can cite countless historical examples of where that happens. And so the more we can communicate this to our children and to our fellow citizens, even if, especially when, we have to do so against the efforts of the state, we've got to do that. That's part of preserving who we are. And we also have to remember that in one sense, the battles we face are not new. Our country was born in a context that is in some ways reminiscent of our own, or at least we can say that our country was born in a context in which we faced a large, distant national government, one that regulated us too aggressively, taxed us oppressively, was so far from the people that it was slow to respond to their needs. And, you know, we didn't have to have everyone involved in the effort to resist that large, distant national government. We didn't even necessarily have to have a majority, but we just had to have enough. Ultimately, that's what we got. We had enough. We're willing to resist that government, and we succeeded. That was a successful effort by America's voluntary civil society. Now, today, fortunately, the revolution that we need has already been fought and won, in the sense that the changes we need today don't require the type of revolution fought with the sword and with the cannon. The type of change that we need today can be fought at the ballot box and can be won without a single drop of blood being spilled. But we do need to fight it nonetheless. We need to fight it aggressively, and we need to fight it by standing behind these same principles that have from the beginning made America exceptional.
Let me interject as well. I mentioned the book before, and the senators mentioned the book. The title's Our Lost Constitution. It's his book on precisely these topics. It's very accessible, and it's not a children's book, but I think it's very accessible, and I think a lot of middle school students and certainly high school students could learn a lot by picking up a copy of the book. I noticed it's still number one on Amazon.com in terms of books about the Constitution, and that's where it's available. It's also available, of course, in bookstores, I assume. So that's one concrete thing I think parents can do with their kids. Let's take another call now.
Hi, my name is Mike Easter. I'm a member out in California, and I truly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for Federalist Society members that they can undertake to try to be ambassadors or advocate some of those principles of American exceptionalism within their communities or other organizations.
You know, it's pretty simple. Just talk. Just talk to people around you. Some people choose to do this through social media. I think that's good. I think that's very helpful because there are a lot of voices on social media, a lot of people who are getting more and more of their information through social media. But whether you do it through social media or in person, or preferably through a combination of the both, talk to people around you, friends, neighbors, coworkers, relatives, aunts, uncles, even the crazy ones. Talk about these things around the dinner table, around the water cooler, around the Christmas tree, any time you get together, whether it's for Christmas or Thanksgiving or 4th of July. Talk to people around you and share your viewpoints. Talk to people about the importance of restoring the basics of our American constitutional system, the two structural protections in the Constitution being federalism and separation of powers. If we did nothing more than just focus on restoring federalism and separation of powers, we could bring about major positive change in America that would strengthen American exceptionalism. You know, the great thing about those principles, federalism and separation of powers, is that on their face, by their nature, they are nonpartisan. They are neither liberal nor conservative. They're neither Republican nor Democratic. These are simply American ideals. And they're ideals that, when properly followed, when aggressively enforced, strengthen the people, make the people stronger, make our civilization stronger. They're politically ecumenical, and these things can be made to appeal to people at every end of the political spectrum. The problem has been that we've had too few people advocating on behalf of these principles as an independent good. And we've had too many people in both political parties who have been willing to sacrifice federalism and separation of powers at the altar of political expediency. And so the more we can talk about those two things, the more we can shape our national political discourse. And as we do that, we'll usher in a new era of American exceptionalism.
Senator, we've got just two questions pending. I know you're, well, I suspect you're probably trying to get back to Utah. Do you have time for a couple more questions? Or?
Sure, sure.
Okay, let's head forth then.
Hello, Senator Lee. This is Jack Etheridge from Columbus, Ohio. Thank you for your time today. Your comments reminded me really how much we have to be grateful for as Americans. And thinking about that, I was reminded of Thomas West's book, Vindicating the Founders, Race, Sex, Class, and Justice in the Origins of America. I was curious if you're familiar with his book and if you have recommendations of other books besides your own, perhaps, that would be helpful on this topic.
You know, I'm not familiar with that book. That's one that I'll have to pick up and would enjoy reading. I can tell you, as far as recommendations on other books, my single favorite book on the topic of American exceptionalism has to be Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. I reread that from time to time. I read it again just in the last 18 months or so. And every time I read it, I'm enlightened by something new that I didn't pick up on before, or something that Tocqueville said that has become even more prescient with the passage of time. So I certainly love that book. I'm also, whenever I'm asked about recommending books, I'm a big fan of a book called Liberal Fascism by Jonah Goldberg. He wrote this book, I think 6 or 7 years ago, and he explains that fascism, properly understood, it focuses on big government, on the brooding omnipresence of the state. It takes on many forms. It doesn't always take on the form of a big, mean institution. We often associate fascism, of course, with violent regimes like those in Nazi Germany. But fascism, as he explains in that book, has other forms, and sometimes it has a more ostensibly benevolent form. In America, it shows up with a happy face instead of showing up with a more threatening symbol. And I think that book, read together with Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, can be very helpful in reminding people of the elements of American exceptionalism.
Thank you for your suggestion. I will note that in Professor West's book, he has one chapter, Chapter 7, Immigration and the Moral Conditions of Citizenship, which I think is perhaps the best material I've ever read on that topic. It's very contemporary interest today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's now take our final question.
Good morning, Senator. This is John Brungart in Kansas City, and I'd like to thank you very much for your presentation this morning and your positions on many of the issues facing us today. I would like to say, though, that when I hear the term American exceptionalism, I'm a little concerned that too often it may give way to a form of hubris or even arrogance in a proponent along the lines that as Americans we're special, that we therefore have special rights or are to be judged by special standards different from those that we would apply to other peoples or countries. Can you speak to that concern?
Sure. And I'm pleased that you raised this concern because it's a very legitimate one and really does need to be addressed. When I speak of American exceptionalism, I often point out at the outset that we are great as Americans not because of who we are, but because of what we do. And whenever we couch the issue this way, whenever we start with the understanding that we're great as Americans not because of who we are, but because of what we do, we tend to encapsulate and incorporate into the discussion the fact that American exceptionalism is a tenuous thing. It is a condition rather than a permanent and immutable characteristic. It is something that we have had in the past, something that we hope to have moving forward, and that we benefit from to the precise extent that we exhibit those characteristics today. But it's not something we can take for granted. It is fleeting in the sense that we can lose it at almost any moment. And we've got to be very careful that we don't proceed with this discussion with an air of arrogance or hubris, not just because those things are bad in and of themselves, which they are, but also because of the fact that those things will cause us, if we're not careful, to lose a grip on what American exceptionalism really is, which is a set of benefits brought about not by who we are, but by what we do.
Thank you very much.
Senator, I want to give you a chance to express a final thought before we wrap up here. But before I do that, let me just outline for our listeners what's coming up in our collaboration with the Washington Times, the content in the Washington Times. All this week, we have essays on American exceptionalism. Next week, we'll spend the entire week looking at different facets of separation of powers. The following full week, we'll look at federalism issues. The week after that, it'll be the First Amendment, looking both at speech and religion issues. And then the final full week of July, we'll be looking at law and innovation, touching on your first pillar, the free enterprise system. So that's our content coming up in the Washington Times, available online, but also in hard copy. And before we adjourn, Senator Lee, do you have a final thought, concluding remark?
Sure. Once again, I want to thank the Federalist Society not only for hosting this event today, but for all that it does in promoting American exceptionalism and promoting the rule of law and constitutionally limited government. Ours is truly a great nation. Although there is a lot of reason for us to be concerned about a lot of things, I still fundamentally believe that our best days as Americans may well lie ahead of us. Again, not because of who we are, but because of what we do. The American people can indeed be counted on to do the right thing, as Winston Churchill said, after they've exhausted every other alternative. And when Churchill made that comment, I don't think he was necessarily intending it as a compliment, but I take it as such because it is what differentiates Americans from other people throughout the world and other civilizations that have existed throughout its history. I hope and believe that we will continue to make right choices, that we will step up our game, and that we will resist efforts to replace these institutions of the free enterprise system and voluntary civil society with the brooding omnipresence of the state. And that as we embrace constitutionally limited government, we will also continue to embrace free markets and voluntary civil society. Those things benefit the people. Those things allow for upward economic mobility. Those are the things that allow people to be born into poverty, but develop the understanding of, that if they work hard and play by the rules, they can eventually retire comfortably or even with a degree of wealth. I appreciate those who have participated in this call today and appreciate all that each of you do within your own communities to promote American exceptionalism and the other ideals that we've discussed today. Thank you very much.
Senator Lee, I want to thank you personally, but on behalf of the Federal Society as well. It's always great to have you here. To our audience, a reminder that our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for Monday at 2 p.m. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.